Session number 27075, reel 22.
Squadron Leader Leggett, reel 22.
So that was quite an adventure. One saw sights one might not otherwise see. And to see the whole of, virtually the whole of Egypt from the air was to say interesting, to say the least of it. And then we returned. I think we thumbed a lift on an American the American Met Service, military air transport service. We just thumbed a ride to Cairo and spent a few days in Cairo, and then we thought we'd better report to somebody. And trotted into AHQ Middle East, and they said, "Oh, you're supposed to be in Aden, aren't you?" "Well, yes, we're on the way back." "Oh, well, off you go." "And in the meantime, you'd better get yourself a posting organised. We'll be wanting you chaps shortly." This was middle of October 1942. So we got back to Aden via what used to be Imperial Air, I think the British BOEC by then, I believe, flying in civilian markings. They took us back to Aden. And no sooner we got there than postings came through, and I was posted to number 73 Squadron. And I wasn't. I was posted to something group, I don't know which group number it was. I had to report to the personnel department at this group headquarters, which was lying in the desert about 20 miles south of Alexandria, I should think.
Can I just ask you what the unit you'd been with in Aden was called?
Oh yes, it was just called the very, very original, the Aden Defence Flight. Yes, Aden Defence Flight. Sadly, after I'd left, I heard one of the other chaps followed on a few days later, and I think it was a day or two after I'd left, two of the guys, Eric Hill was one, and Eric Hill and, oh dear, what's his name? I can see him, I can't get his name. And they were up doing their little early morning bit, having a little dogfight together, and they collided. They're both killed. Yeah. So I arrived at this desert air headquarters and went in to see the personnel officer. And he said, "Right, hurricanes." Well, by this time the Desert Air Force had got some Spitfires. Not many, but they got some. And I said, "I'd rather like to go on to Spitfires." "Oh, no. There's not time for any conversion flights at this stage. We've got a war on here, you know. You can't frig around changing aeroplanes. You're a Hurricane pilot. You've got to fly Hurricanes." I said, "I've just come out of Malta, you know. We took a beating there. We lost a lot of hurricanes. I'd like to get some of my own back." Oh. And he picked up the phone, spoke to somebody. "I see, sir." "Yes," he said. Yes, of course. Yes, I understand, sir. Yes. Well, this young officer was, he's been pressurizing me, you see, sir. And I felt the least I could do was get a decision. I decided. I said, "Well, sorry," said SPSO, says, no. "We want everything organized, and you'll soon find out why. We can't frig around changing airplanes at this stage." But he said, "You've got a bit of night flying, haven't you?" I said, "Yes, I was in a night squadron in the UK." Right, he said. Well, now, 73 Squadron, one of their best known squadrons in the RAF, did a big job in France. And he said they are operating Hurricanes armed with four cannon, and they're carrying out night air defense over the battle area. And may possibly be used in night strafing operations. How does that sound to you? I said, well, yes, sooner flies a bit far, but okay. Right, we're just off together, and off I went. And the truck took me to LG, whatever it was, miles from anywhere, out in the Western Desert. Doesn't say. Some airfields in the desert had names, name of the local village. Others just landing ground number so and so. And so I arrived in what could only be described as a stretch of desert, which bristled lots and lots of tents, and some Hurricanes, all painted black. And climbed out of the truck, and first thing I did was bump into Tommy Thompson, who was an old friend from Northfield days. The next chap I bumped into was Bert Ambrose. Amber, I called him. An old friend from Northfield days. Oh, the guy who got killed in there, and the other guy was Blackburn, yes. All blackers. And I think there were one or two others too. However, there were certainly these two old friends. And so it was home from home again.
I was going to say, because obviously moving around the Air Force with different postings, you often would bump into the same people.
This is exactly how it was. Yes, it was just like this.
Is that a comforting feeling when you arrive at a squadron?
Oh, you think, yes. Sometimes through the grapevine, you might have heard that, oh, so-and-so is at so-and-so, or is in such-and-such a squadron. So if you got it in any way involved, you know, you'd probably see old so-and-so. So, yes, and throughout the whole of one's Air Force career, this is exactly what it was. You go from posting to posting, and nine times out of ten, there'd always be at least one or two people you knew. Some you knew very well, others just acquaintances. But you're seldom out on a limb all by yourself, surrounded by total strangers. Within commands, that is to say, there was very little crossbreeding between commands. Nearly always, people who went on to fighters stayed on fighters. Sometimes they might go to others. Some might go to bombers, possibly. But that was unusual. It was even more unusual for people to come from other commands to fighters. Bomber boys usually stayed bomber boys, or maybe coastal or whatever. But it was most unusual for anybody to come to fighters from other commands. So within fighter command, or within the fighter world, these are the people you knew. If you happened for any reason to find yourself on another command's airfield, it would be most unlikely to be anybody there. But they themselves, of course, within their sphere of influence, they the same would apply in their case.
Would there be any sort of rivalry between the different commands at all?
Sympathy more than anything, I think. We didn't envy the bombers lot, whatever, what at all. In the early days, it seemed it was a bit of a drudgery, flogging round in Wellingtons and Hampdens and things, on dark nights and so on. I think it was just taken for granted that was their job, and it wasn't until later on, when the losses started to mount, that one realised that they'd got a very nasty job on their hands altogether. Now I've lost my thread.
Well, one thing I was actually wondering about as well, because you had daytime operations and nighttime operations.
Mm.
Was that unusual to have the two in fighter command?
No, it wasn't really. I think very what may sometimes happen, you'd get people going from day to night squadrons, but it'd be unusual for them to go back the other way. I think that's the case. I think what would tend to happen would be at the end of a night fighter tour, you'd probably then go to the training machine in one shape or another, almost certainly to an operational training unit. I think that would be the most likely outcome. Sometimes people might go into the flying training machine, the advanced flying schools. Didn't hear of people going to elementary flying schools there after operations. They might go to they might possibly go and do what was it called, can't think of the name of CFS, Central Flying School. Yes, Central Flying School was where instructors were instructed, and sometimes people would be posted. If they're particularly good pilots, but not terribly good operational pilots, I think these might be shunted off to do a Central Flying School course with a view to becoming senior instructors. I think this is the way it worked.
At the airfield, obviously in the Western Desert, you mentioned there was a number of tents, so was accommodation all in tents?
Oh yes, yes, entirely. I think the only people who had anything other than a tent was General Montgomery, who had a caravan. we would pile all our stuff onto the back of a truck. The driver would be told where he'd got to go. How he ever found the place, God only knows. We'd climb into our Hurricanes, and off we'd go up to the next landing ground, or whatever it was called. If the timing was right, there'd be somebody there, an advance party, to receive the aircraft in. Usually they'd have a refueling tanker with them. So that as soon as we arrived, we could be refueled at least. And then it was a case of waiting for the main party to arrive with everything, all the gear, and get us set up operationally. In practice, we could be operational very quickly. One of the two occasions, one in particular, a place called Wadi Tanat, which was the on the approaches to Tripoli. And we just landed there. We're just walking away from our aircraft virtually, when some Italians, of all people, decided to do a bit of strafing. And indeed, they did knock out two Hurricanes. And then, yes, there was It was they did this low strafing attack, and they were immediately pounced upon by some Spitfires. And that was quite a good scene. They shot down, the Spits shot down two or three of them. But they set fire to two of our Hurricanes.
Would that be the Mackies again?
Yes, they were the Mackie 202s. Yeah. Yes, they were, it was quite a good airplane. In the right hands, they were all right.
I was thinking with the landing strips you were on, obviously you were in tents.
Mm.
Would that be a tent to yourself, or would there be...
No, we'd share. Usually there'd be two to a tent. We'd have a just an ordinary little Boy Scouts tent, really, with room for two. We'd have camp beds, folding camp beds, and a bed roll, which was blankets, which all rolled up. We'd have a folding wash basin, which is just a canvas bag thing in a wooden folding wooden stand, which we would and we'd be issued with a jerry can of water to per tent. And when you use it up, if there's any more left, you can have another one. But if there wasn't, hard luck, you wait for the next lorry to come in. And the result was that sometimes this water would tend to get rather solid, at least a bit. Even if there are only two people sharing the same one, as was the case sometimes. And it would get pretty grotty. But we only used it for shaving, so it didn't matter too much.
Would you be required to shave every day?
No, not required, but we all did. Can't recall anybody in a beard. Oh, Amber did for a short period. He and I shared a tent. And he did for a short period. He got some skin disease, I think. And he had to grow a beard for a bit, but they got over it and they shaved it off. But no, they weren't well. Clothing, on the other hand, was to say the least of it, non-regulation. In fact, one virtually wore what one felt like wearing.
What did you wear?
I just wore the ordinary khaki shorts. Khaki shorts and just the ordinary. I say the ordinary stuff. No, when I was down in Aden, that's right. We went to Aden, having been issued with all this awful old khaki drill stuff, reached down to the knees and was all baggy and scratchy and generally awful. And in Aden, we did kit ourselves out with some rather nice khaki coloured, but much, much nicer fabrics altogether. Poplin shirts and tailored shorts, and so we got all that kit with us, and that's what I wore all the way through the desert until the winter came. And winter did come. Alamein, of course, was 23rd of October, I think, and it was probably into end of November, early December. And we went into uniform then, because, as the saying goes, the sands of the desert grow cold. And it does get very cold indeed, in fact.
Would you be wearing the flying boots or shoes at that point?
Yes. Had I still got my boots, I'm sure I had. I think during the summer it was shoes. Yes, during the hot weather it was shoes. But I used to wear flying boots in the colder weather. Well, that's the Aden Defence flag. So then we had the Battle of Alamein. And our job initially was to cover the battle area. And we'd simply have a night flying program. We'd do the usual night squadron drill. We'd do our air test during the afternoon. And the aircraft would all be fueled up. ready for the night's program. We should be posted up. We'd all be given the takeoff time. But the operational area was the same every time, over the battle line, wherever that might be. Well, all squadrons had an ALO, Army Liaison Officer. We had a splendid fellow, typical, we called them Pongos, typical Pongo type. Waxed moustache, great sense of fun. Never appeared to take anything at all seriously. Quite smartly turned out, but like everybody in the desert, he wore his brothel creeping shoes, suede, rubber soled shoes. And as it started to get dark and the first sortie was due to go off, we'd have our briefing from the ALO. And his job was to plot on the map the bomb line. And the bomb line was where you did not go to do anything offensive unless you were told to do so. In this case, during the battle, I think I'm right saying it started on the 23rd of October, and it was announced in our mess tent by a distant rumbling and a vibration. And this rumbling and vibration was the famous 8th Army barrage when Montgomery put down 1,000 guns and they all let loose at the same time. And it was quite spectacular. The whole of the western sky would just light up. We were about, we had two airfields, LG something or other, which was about 20 miles behind the battle line, and Burgle Arab, which is about 10 miles behind the battle line. And we'd go up to Burgle Arab before it was dark and be organized from there. And when the barrage opened up, you could feel the ground trembling, and you could the coffee mugs on the table start chittering, and it was quite extraordinary. So then during the night we'd go off one by one, expecting to find some German aircraft over the battle area. But they didn't come, and we went off one after the other, nothing happening. I went off, I think it was probably the second or third night, and round about midnight, there was a brilliant moon, little white, patchy, fluffy clouds dotted around, and control came on and gave me a target. He gave me a course to stay on a height, which I followed, and he said, sorry, the plot's faded, which simply meant they'd lost him. Well, that could have been a number of reasons. It could have been simply that the radar weren't picking him up for some reason, or he just decided to dive away. I think it was about 10 or 12,000 feet when they put me onto him. But he might just have dived away and gone below radar height, I don't know. And then they suddenly came back and gave me another course to steer. So I settled on this course, and all of a sudden there was the most tremendous flash. And I felt sure it was an AK-AK shell, and I felt pretty sure I must have been hit in something or other. But everything seemed to be all right, all the controls were working, there was no apparent damage. I was a bit dazzled by this bright flash. And when I sorted myself out, I went into a a gentle turn, and then I saw something shining in my reflector mirror, bright light. So I turned around towards it, and it turned out to be a parachute flare. And evidently what had happened, this chap had dropped his parachute flare, which had opened and ignited just above my cockpit. So I was lucky to get away with that, I suppose. But I thought, well, our chaps on the ground don't want this. So, and it was surprising the amount of light it was shedding by now. It was coming down. It was shedding quite a lot of light. You could see a lot of detail on the ground. It was surprising. And so I lined up and fired at it. Well, the first thing I realized was that ranging, this is on a parachute flare, can be quite alarming. So it seems to be a long way off one moment, and all of a sudden it rushes at you. And you've got to dive, get out of the way quickly. Anyway, I hit the thing. It was just a shower of sparks, and it all went floating down, and so that was that. And the time came to finish my sortie. So I headed back down the coast. Navigation was absolutely no problem. You just follow the coastline. And we had got our marker flares out in the desert. They were just a triangle of three flares. Anywhere in the desert, we simply had a compass course from that triangle of lights to our base. We just flew that course. And with any luck, you'd pick up the glim lamps and land. And I think no, I can't remember whether it was that night or another one. I think it must have been another night. I know a sandstorm blew up, and they could sometimes develop very quickly. And I was on the way back from my patrol, and this sandstorm blew up. And I could hardly see the three lights. I could only just pick them out. And by the time I got there, they disappeared altogether. So I just took a guess at where they were and steered a course from that point. But I couldn't see the glim lamps. They just didn't come up. And so I called up and said that I was unable to pick up the flare path. And so they said, stand by. And a few moments later, two red flares went up. So I streaked towards where these red flares were. And there, sure enough, was the row of glim lamps. I managed to just plop it down, and this sandstorm came across. And it really was quite vicious. It was almost impossible to see a taxi. Complete blot out. A nasty thing, sandstorms. But from our point of view, the Battle of Alamein was just a jolly good place to watch the war going on. We sat up there, 10 or 12,000 feet or whatever, and watched it all happening down there, and it was an incredible sight. It really was quite astonishing. Flashes and flares and clouds of dust and smoke all going up. Tracer going in all directions, bombs bursting here. It really was fantastic. And if one had happened to have a camera with one up the top, you could have made a nice little line with that film.
While you were patrolling at the heights you were patrolling at, could you actually hear the bombardment? Could you hear the bombardment from those heights?
Oh, no, you wouldn't hear anything at all. It would just be flashes all along. The geography, I'm sure you know, the so-called village of El Alamein is on the coast, and the battle line, the El Alamein line, stretched from that point due south, to the Qatar Depression, which was this big, impassable area of soft sand. And the battle was being conducted between those two points. And our job was to simply go up and down the line, waiting for some Germans to come and join in the battle. But they didn't come. At least very few of them came. There were one or two. But they didn't come. One chap did think he'd got something. He chased something out across the sea and fired at it. He wasn't too sure whether he could make a claim or not. I think in the event they said, well, all right, we call it a probable, but we don't think it's very probable. But this was an extraordinary thing. We learned afterwards, of course, that the Germans were so short of fuel that they just couldn't afford to put aircraft up unless there was some definite return going to be achieved.